Today on the LA Food Podcast, I'm your host Lucas Servodio, feeling great about the Dodgers prospects as the baseball season gets off to a fantastic start. That Shohei Ohtani guy seems like a sure bet, am I right? Speaking of sure bets, we're joined today by Scott Linder, one of the founders and operating partners behind Matu, which just might be my favorite steakhouse in all of Los Angeles. Matu is famous for its dedication to serving only the highest quality grass-fed Wagyu beef, but that's not all. As they were getting ready to launch the restaurant, Scott and his fellow founders spent a ridiculous amount of time and effort nailing down all of the variables that go into preparing the product correctly and serving it up in a way that leads to maximum flavor and satisfaction. Scott joins us to talk all things beef, but also how he got into the position of being the culinary mind behind all that Matu has to offer. He tells us about his love for Iron Chef, his time spent traveling the world as the private chef to an A-list celebrity famous for doing their own stunts, and how one fateful afternoon with Jerry Greenberg led him to moving to Los Angeles and betting it all on beef. Of course, I couldn't let him leave without asking him about Matu's legendary Philly cheesesteak. How did they come up with it? And what makes it so damn irresistible? It's a beefcake of an episode, dear listener. But first, a few things that caught my eye. There's change coming to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, a crisis at the health department, and several excellent restaurant reviews I want you to go check out. So without further ado, let's chow down. The LA Food Podcast is brought to you by House of Macadamias. Dear listener, do you have a favorite nut? Here's why I've happily given that title over to the macadamia. First, it's chock full of nutritional benefits, including one of the best omega 6 to 3 ratios in the nut game, 8 times better than pistachios and 20 times better than cashews. Cashew? More like cash-ew. Second, it's super versatile. You can have them as a snack. You can find tons of applications to include them in your cooking. You can even use the oil for cooking, in addition to using it for skin and health purposes. If you want to get in on the macadamia game, head to the LA Food Pod page on houseofmacadamias.com to access my curated list of macadamia products. We've got extra virgin cold-pressed macadamia oil, savory macadamia snack packs, and salted or unsalted macadamia nut butter. All great for snacking, all great for cooking. The best part is, when you buy an LA Food Pod bundle on houseofmacadamias.com, you'll instantly get a free multi-pack of macadamia snack bars featuring flavors like chocolate, white chocolate, and coconut white chocolate. And if you subscribe to our bundle, you get a 15% discount on all of it. And don't worry, you can pause, cancel, or adjust the subscription at any time. So what are you waiting for? Head to www.houseofmacadamias.com/pages/LA-foods and go nuts. Dear listener, I hope your week is off to a fantastic finish, I should say, because we're heading into the weekend. My week's gone pretty well. It's been full of a lot of eating. Father Saul, who you know from this podcast, is actually in town from Seattle, where he usually lives, and we've been doing a ton of eating. In fact, next week's episode will be entirely recapping the food crawl and food haul that we've been doing this week. We've hit up some excellent spots, including Felix in Venice last night, courtesy of friend of the pod, Brad Metzger, and his lovely wife, Linda. I can't wait to recap our meal at Felix for you next week. You know, if you've heard me talk on the podcast before, you know that I've had some mild criticisms of Evan Funky restaurants, but I gotta say, my tide might be turning on Evan Funky after all, okay? So stay tuned. We'll talk about it more next week. But in the meantime, I wanted to tell you about a few things that caught my eye this week. If you've been following the news in the last couple weeks, I would say, you might have heard of a plan called Access to Hollywood. And no, I'm not talking about the celebrity news channel that my wife likes to have on the TV sometimes. No, it's called Access to Hollywood, and it is a Hollywood sidewalk expansion plan that Los Angeles City officials announced last week. Basically, what this would do is it would add wider sidewalks, bus lanes, and extensive bike lanes to the Walk of Fame and surrounding neighborhoods, including like Thai Town, even ranging into Los Feliz. It's going to cost the city about $8 million, funded primarily by Metro, and it's designed to increase mobility options, they say, and boost pedestrian safety. What that really means is they want to get people out of cars, they want to diminish traffic, and they basically want to try to encourage people to adopt alternate modes of transportation, including like metro or bikes. Tangibly, what it's going to look like, it's going to look like an extensive protected bike lane on Hollywood Boulevard that ranges from La Brea to Silver Lake's Fountain Avenue, and then bus lanes on Hollywood Boulevard from Orange Drive to Gower Street. Now, why are we talking about this on a food podcast? Well, part of the conversation has surrounded the possibility for an addendum and extended alfresco dining across Hollywood Boulevard that would affect places that we all know and love, like Musso and Frank on the Walk of Fame, Home State in Los Feliz, Friends and Family in Thai Town. Those are just a few examples that Mona Holmes actually brought up in her Eater reporting, and I'm sure that there are many others. That dining portion isn't confirmed yet. However, I feel like it would be an essential part to actually make this Hollywood sidewalk expansion a success, right? If you ask me, that would be a fantastic idea because let's face it, the Hollywood Walk of Fame is the worst part of Los Angeles. I don't know if you've ever had to deal with out-of-town visitors, dear listener, but one of the places my out-of-town visitors always want to go is the goddamn Hollywood Walk of Fame. And it is one of the worst places in Los Angeles. It's seedy, it's dirty, it's frankly like one of the biggest letdowns. You know, I remember when I first came to Los Angeles as a teenager to visit with my family, and they took me to the Hollywood Walk of Fame. I was so disillusioned. It was almost like finding out that Santa wasn't real. And I do apologize for any children or adults out there who only just found out that Santa isn't real right now. I just think that there's so much more that we can do with what is a historic part of Los Angeles, and this is definitely a step in the right direction. However, it seems like outdoor dining isn't a sure thing. Extended outdoor dining isn't a sure thing. So as people who are watching this, as consumers, as people who, you know, watch City Hall and are interested in our restaurants, we should keep an eye on it just to see if perhaps it's something that we need to be reaching out to our city council members to ask for, to advocate for, especially if you live in CD4 or CD13, the Hollywood areas. I think that this could be something that you might want to get activated on, and just let's help improve the Walk of Fame, guys. I believe we can do it. We've seen things like this work in other cities around the country. Famously, Times Square did something like this, and apparently it's like become one of the places to hang out with nice little parklets and places that you can like go drink wine. Why not have that on the Walk of Fame? Why not? Okay, moving away from the Walk of Fame, I wanted to quickly talk about a serious report that the Los Angeles Times put out earlier this week. It's about the staffing at the health department. And we've heard a lot about the staffing in restaurants and how difficult it's been for restaurants to attract and retain talent. But apparently the same is true at the health department. So the report was conducted by the Los Angeles Times' Rebecca Ellis. And frankly, it's one of the best pieces I've seen come out from the paper in a while. Basically, they found that out of the roughly 18,000 quote-unquote high-risk food facilities that typically are supposed to get 3 inspections a year from the health department, fewer than 2% actually received those 3 reviews. 3 in 10 restaurants out of those high-risk food facilities didn't even receive 1 inspection from the health department. Well, basically, why this is it comes down to staffing. It sounds like since the pandemic, the health department has pretty much been hemorrhaging staff, and they haven't been backfilling those positions fast enough. And what that has done is it's put a strain on the people who still work for the health department, who are basically having to, you know, be overworked, go do their inspections, do them in a way that isn't even very thorough. Apparently, they say they feel rushed when they're doing these inspections, and it's leading, as we just, you know, listed with the stats, to most restaurants not receiving the health inspections that they should be getting. Now, I know on the face, you're probably like, okay, well, restaurants aren't getting inspected. Surely that's, maybe that's a break for some restaurants. You know, whenever we see health inspectors come to restaurants in movies like The Bear, it's always like the big bad health inspector coming to like deliver horrible news or like find roaches, right? Truth is though, this is actually a case of restaurants not getting what they paid for, because high-risk facilities, which are the ones that should be getting inspected at least 3 times a year, they actually pay more in permit fees to the county in order to cover the cost of those inspections. So they are required to pay those fees, but they're not getting the inspections they're paying for. And we know how tight margins are for restaurants. Those permits aren't cheap. So not a great look for the county to basically be, you know, taking money from these restaurants without giving them what they paid for, which are the inspections. So that is not a good thing for restaurants. I think that the county needs to do something to either, you know, perhaps refund those restaurants who are not getting inspected, or to just step up their game and offer those inspections. What does this mean for us as diners? Well, one thing came to mind, actually. I don't know if you're one of those people who gets severely turned off when you go past a restaurant and you see like a B or C rating, right? Or God forbid, a D rating. Personally, I get turned on when I see something like that. If I see a B rating, a C rating, I'm in, you know? I think I once heard on an Anthony Bourdain show that that was a sure sign of a good time, so to speak. However, I know plenty of people who see who will not go into a restaurant if they see a B rating, my wife included, okay? My thing with this is, we know that these restaurants aren't getting the inspections that they're paying for, right? And if I was a restaurant and I got a B rating or a C rating, what would I do? Well, I would haul ass to try to amend that rating, right? I would probably go out of my way to ensure whatever was found was basically rectified. However, if the health department isn't coming back to reinspect us and up our rating, that B or C rating might be lingering in the window long past, you know, the actual offense. So to me, these days, knowing that the health department is so slammed, it's not getting to its inspections, if you see a B or a C rating in a window, take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. Check it out for yourself. Obviously, you're not going to be able to go into the kitchen and, you know, inspect it yourself unless you do want to embark on some sort of guerrilla inspection, which the LA Food Podcast does not recommend. Go in, check it out for yourself. Don't be turned off. Chances are that restaurant has done everything they can to rectify the situation, and they may have just not been inspected by the health department yet, who's severely backed up. Anyways, finally, before we dive into our conversation on steaks with Scott Linder, I wanted to quickly point out a few fun food reviews that I came across this week that I think deserve your attention, dear listener. First and foremost, you know, this actually came out last week, but it was right after we recorded the podcast. It always happens to be like the case that right after I hit publish on the podcast, some amazing story breaks or some amazing review drops. It's like the curse of the LA Food Podcast. However, this week I'm not forgetting, because there was a very special review, and it was from Jen Harris, our beloved Jen Harris, who everybody in the LA food scene loves to read her articles, loves to see her posts about the best things that she ate the week gone by. A true force for like positivity in the food scene of Los Angeles, and we absolutely applaud that. Now, she actually published her first review as a critic last week. And maybe you think like, well, she's constantly doing that, isn't she? No, there's a difference, right? She writes columns, right? And she's able to give her opinions on food in those. She obviously offers her takes on food on social media. However, she's never written a formal review a la Bill Addison, a la Jonathan Gold before. And she was afforded this opportunity just last week, and she took it to review Sophie's Cambodian Town Food and Music in Long Beach. I absolutely love that the Times gave Jen the opportunity to review a restaurant as a critic. I think it's incredible. First of all, there's no reason why we should only have one food critic in Los Angeles or at the Los Angeles Times. You know, for a while there, the Los Angeles Times did have a couple critics. Now, that didn't end in the best way. However, I do think there was some good journalism happening during that time. And there are criticisms made of Bill Addison that he doesn't get to enough restaurants. I've heard that criticism made. I personally think it's unfair. However, I do think we need more food critics in this city. In fact, Bill Addison said that himself on a podcast recently. I think this is great. Let's get more voices in there. Jen Harris is a deserving voice to be, you know, offering her food in the position of formal critic. So I don't know if there's going to be more of this in the future, but I absolutely applaud this happening. I highly, highly recommend that everybody goes and checks this out. I will put it in the show notes. Sticking with the LA Times, I also wanted to put your attention to an excellent guide they published on Koreatown. They basically put out three separate guides on Koreatown that sort of like ladder up into one overall guide on how to eat in Koreatown. One is a list of the best fried chicken places. One is a list of the best late night eats. And finally, there's one of the best K barbecue spots. I think this is a fantastic thing for the Times to do. I want to see more of this. I want to see them go neighborhood by neighborhood. We do see this already with the Infatuation and Eater, but there's just the quality of the Times just hits different, you know? It just hits different. And I think it's extremely apparent in this package that they put together. So go and check it out for yourself, dear listener. Although I did want to say real quick, Sunnongdan, one of my favorite restaurants in Koreatown that's famous for their Kalbi Jjim, that incredible short rib beef stew, it's only getting a passing mention in one of the articles and is not included on any of their lists. Am I missing something? Did Sunnongdan go downhill? Last time I went, it was still hidden. If anybody has any information as to why Sunnongdan was left off this list, by all means, please share it. But to me, it seems like the one sort of like stain on an otherwise excellent package. Finally, last review I wanted to point your attention to. Our friends at The Infatuation are known for their humorous writing, and Brant Cox wrote a pretty hilarious takedown of Sir Restaurant and Lounge. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's in West Hollywood. It's owned by Lisa Vanderpump of Vanderpump Rules, and it's kind of just really basically a stage for the show. You know, it's not really considered, I think, a serious restaurant by any means, although they definitely would have you think it's a serious restaurant on the show. But Brant went over there and he wrote a pretty funny review of it. He gave it a 3.8. Look, typically I hate it when people go to restaurants and just use it as an opportunity to shit on the restaurant. The only times I think it's acceptable are if you're doing it to a big multi like national chain like an Olive Garden or a KFC or something like that, right? Where one person's opinion isn't going to actually hurt that business, nor you know, is it going to change that many hearts and minds. It's more for the humor. And while Sir Restaurant and Lounge doesn't really fall in that category, its success is not based on the food. Its success is based on its association with Vanderpump Rules. Its, you know, success is based on its association with Lisa Vanderpump herself. So I don't think Brant's takedown of the food will hurt the restaurant, and therefore I fully endorse you going over and reading this pretty hilarious piece. In fact, my favorite line that he had in the piece was about the service. He was saying that they sat down to drink the waters that were at the table, except for the fact that the waiter quickly informed them moments after they had taken a sip that those water glasses had actually been left behind from a previous table. That's got to be one of my worst nightmares. It's kind of like hopping into what you think is an Uber only to figure out that it's just a regular citizen's car. It's one of those like jarring feelings of like, I am not supposed to be here at this moment. And my heart goes out to Brant and his colleagues that experienced that at Sir, but it makes for a very funny anecdote, and I thank them for that. Well, that'll probably be enough of a monologue for today. So without further ado, we're going to move on to our conversation with Scott Linder. Joining us today on the LA Food Podcast, he's one of the founders behind Matu, the beloved steak restaurant in Beverly Hills. It's Scott Linder. Scott, how you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Oh, I'm fantastic. Scott, where are you calling us from today?
Sunny Southern California, Los Angeles.
Finally sunny, right? Have you been surviving the rain?
Barely. But you know, we don't get rain, you know, but every 2 years, so I take it in when I can.
Totally. It looks like you're calling us, and I said this before we actually started recording, looks like you're calling us from like a television set kitchen.
This is the home office. This is my kitchen. This is where all of my Zoom calls and computer work takes at. This is the office.
Well, I feel like it is pretty important for a chef or someone who cooks a lot to have a nice kitchen.
It certainly helps. It certainly helps.
Yeah, I can see, like, when you're looking for an apartment, you're probably like, I don't care if the rest of it looks like a trap house. As long as the kitchen is fine, I'm good.
I could care less. I don't even know what my bedroom looks like, to be honest.
You just sleep on the counter. Yeah. Good for you. Good for you. Scott, I know that you currently live in Los Angeles, obviously, but you did not grow up here. If I'm not mistaken, you grew up on the other coast.
The other coast, the East Coast. So I'm originally from Pittsburgh.
Right.
I moved to Atlanta when I was really young. So spent kind of my formative years and youth and growing up in Atlanta.
So does that make you a Pittsburgh sports fan or an Atlanta sports fan?
Oh, my God. I knew you were going to ask that. Depends on who's winning. I love Steelers football. My childhood home actually was on the hill overlooking where Heinz Field is. So I'd be kind of remiss to say that I'm not a big Pittsburgh Steelers fan, but love the Steelers, love the Falcons, love the Braves.
I was going to say probably Braves over Pirates recently.
In recent years, yeah, for sure.
Question is, what do you do on basketball? That seems like a dicey one.
I grew up going to a lot of Hawks games. I don't know. It's been rough.
Yeah, it's been rough. Trae Young, not quite the draft pick y'all thought it was going to be. Now, this is not, unfortunately, a sports podcast, although it sounds like we could probably, you know, manage our way on one. Speaking of Atlanta, though, I'd love to know what Scott was like as a kid. Were you just cooking up a storm, or did you have other interests?
So, oddly enough, I was not – my family is not a foodie family. My family's kind of view on food is, you know, we eat food because we got to live and you got to eat dinner and you got to eat lunch and breakfast. So it was not the kind of foodie upbringing that, you know, most chefs or people in the business have, where their Nona was, you know, they're picking tomatoes with Nona in the garden and making a wonderful tomato sauce. That was not my upbringing. And often it's a joke that my friends will say that I started cooking because my mom was so bad at cooking that I wanted to know what good food actually tasted like. So
is there any truth to that?
Oh my God. Well, maybe a little bit.
Yeah. What was Mama Linder cooking?
So I have a twin brother and an older brother. So there was three guys growing up. So it was as much meat as possible over as much starch as possible. So it was a lot of ground beef dinner served over rice, you know, multiple baked chicken breasts, that kind of thing. So nothing fancy or extraordinary, really, really great.
It was about getting the nutrients in.
It was about getting a lot of food in, yeah.
Ironic given what your current line of work is. Absolutely. Now, when it was your sort of choice of where you would want to go eat, what kind of things did you gravitate towards? What were your favorite, like, you know, fast food spots, or, you know, what do they got out there in Atlanta that's good?
You know, growing up, you know, Chick-fil-A was a big staple growing up. Chick-fil-A was kind of it's an Atlanta-based business. They were, when I was growing up, They had a bunch of locations in Atlanta, and that was kind of the place to go hang out after school. Waffle House. I don't know how much you know about a Waffle House, but that is after high school football games, late nights. That's the meeting place.
That was the meeting place. Yeah, but I've never been to a Waffle House, although I've heard they're very, you know, associated with the Atlanta world, as is Chick-fil-A. So it's definitely on my bucket list to do. Not in the immediate future, of course. How did the cooking bug enter your life amidst all the football and Waffle House?
So I got into cooking kind of a strange story. I was, you know, now everybody works at home, and, you know, not a lot of people, you know, people go into the office, but, you know, back in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, everybody was going into the office. So in the summertime, you know, both my parents would go to work, and I remember sitting at home watching the old Iron Chef when it was, you know, Chef Sakai and all I think it was largely based in Japan. So it was all these, you know, chefs in a country in a far off land that I've never been to. And I remember seeing specifically an episode where they were cooking eels. And I remember I'd never seen an eel. I didn't know you could eat eel. And I remember watching this episode, and they took these things that looked like snakes living in the water, which they are, and in an hour turning them into six or seven just like beautiful dishes. And I was like, holy crap, this is so cool that there's a group of people out there that can actually do this. They can take these ingredients and in an hour turn them into beautiful dishes. And they were using ingredients I had never heard of, techniques I had never heard of. You know, it was, I remember it just being so mesmerizing to me that was the kind of, that gave me the bug.
Was it the like competition aspect, the sports aspect of it, or was it more so the learning about new kinds of foods and sort of that awe and wonder of it?
I think it was more about, you know, the culture of it. You know, again, the kind of household, I wasn't eating Japanese food or Malaysian food growing up. So, you know, I was, you know, eating a lot of, you know, pretty simple, you know, basic foods. And I remember seeing all this and thinking, wow, that, you know, there's all these different foods that I'd never had before that mm-hmm. people are eating, and that's a part of their culture. So I think that was more, I mean, I love the competition part of it, but I think it was more the culture that really kind of hooked me.
Yeah, for sure. So what was the first foray into the kitchen based off that inspiration? What did you try to make?
So I remember my mom bought me the Brennan family cookbook. It was a Brennan's is a restaurant in New Orleans. And she had bought me the cookbook. And my mom didn't know anything about cooking, but I think she just picked it up somewhere. But I still have it in my office today. But I remember looking through it and thinking, again, that kind of same concept where I was looking at this cookbook. And this is New Orleans. New Orleans is about a 7-hour drive from Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, holy crap, there's people eating turtle soup and stuffed quail and crawfish etouffee in a place that's a 7-hour drive. And, you know, Creole food just being a part of American culture. I was like, it just dawned on me that I didn't know that kind of food existed. So I remember, you know, I would pick a recipe out of that cookbook, and my mom would take me to the grocery store, and I'd try to make the recipe and inevitably fail at making the recipe because I had no idea what I was doing. But I just remember how much fun it was going and buying, you know, andouille sausage and rice and peppers and all these different things, and just, you know, really trying to make a great dish out of it.
Any early hits? Any ones where you were like, holy fuck, I got something here. I got some talent.
There was certainly no, oh my God, this is it. I think there are a lot of, that's really nice, sweetie. You did a really good job, and I'm very proud of you. And a lot of scraping into garbage cans. I don't remember anything that was really great. I remember, I think I tried making creme brulee, and I did the whole thing where you bake it in the bain-marie, the water bath, and I got like the little ramekins that you bake the creme brulee in. And I torched it, and my family thought it was so cool. And I think that was really good. I think that was like the first, like, oh my God, I actually made something that people not just, you know, are willing to eat, but they really liked it. So I think that was kind of the first time I made something that, you know, people really liked.
Ironic that was a sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so much of my cooking now is even sugar or sweet based. So
when were you like, hey, you know what, this creme brulee hit a little too hard, I think I'm gonna have to do this for a living?
Well, you know, oddly enough, my first ever job was in working for Cold Stone.
You were one of those people doing the mix-ins?
I was singing the jingles.
No way. You still remember any of them?
I remember there was like a Queen, like a rendition of a Queen song, like We Are Cold Stone, like instead of We Are like,
yeah.
So there's like a Queen
like
song.
We Are the Cold Stone, like We Are the Champions.
Yeah, it's like We Are Cold Stone, and I remember having to sing that song every time one of my idiot friends would throw a nickel into our tip jar. and then when they would throw the nickel in, there was another jingle that you would sing, like, like row, row, row your boat, but it was tip, tip, tip your crew. So my friends got a very good laugh every time I had to sing for their nickels.
That's hilarious. I would have been throwing so many nickels in your tip jar. So that was your first foray, but that wasn't what gave you the bug, was it?
No, so I did that, and I remember going back home and cooking food and really wanting a job in an actual kitchen. I mean, I've been watching Iron Chef at this point for years, and I was like, I really actually want to get in one of these crazy kitchens. I read Kitchen Confidential, and I was like, this is, I really want to see what this is all about. And my dad, one of his good friends, lived near an actual working chef. And this guy, Patrick Gabriel, who was a chef of a country club at the time, graciously talked to my father. My father was like, my son, I must have been 15 or 16 at the time. And, talked to my dad and said, hey, my son would really like to learn how to cook. And Patrick was wonderful enough and said, as long as his grades are, are still good and he does everything that he needs to do for school, he can come in and learn and I'll teach him whatever he'd like to know. So that was my first job. And it was, a true legit kitchen. Patrick, wonderful chef. Amazing. He was my kind of first mentor. Still a very good friend of mine and still what I consider a mentor today. He's the guy, and he's oddly enough, my twin brother, he's his business partner. They have a USDA processing high-end charcuterie business that they both run together.
No way. So. Good meat runs in the family then.
Yeah, that's our tagline.
That's your tagline. Yeah, well, I had a similar tagline when I used to hit the bar scene, but we don't need to talk about that. Okay, you did end up going to culinary school though, right? Did you explore other career paths before that?
When I first stepped into a kitchen and I was working with Patrick, it was no turning back. I mean, I immediately knew, hey, this is for me. I want to do this. I think this is great. I asked Patrick, I'd like to go to culinary school. He had gone to the Culinary Institute of America, which is in Hyde Park, New York. He said, just so you know, it's a really tough business. And if you work for me for a year and you really like it, I'll do everything I can to make sure, you get into the school. At this time, they were kind of a lot more stringent on taking applicants. I'll make sure you get into the school. I'll make sure that you're set up there. And, I'll call my old cronies and ask them, to make sure, show you around and et cetera, et cetera. So worked there for a year, decided, this is what I want to do. And went to culinary school. And from there, did an externship at Le Cirque while I was in culinary school, which was no longer there, but it was the place to eat, 80s, 90s, the famous French restaurant.
Ruth Reichel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And had the chance to work with, a lot of great, amazing chefs. It was great, a tremendous experience.
Well, basically, I know from culinary school, you ended up going into the private chef route. How did you make that decision? What was the crossroads there?
It was quite the entrance into the private chef world. So when I graduated from culinary school, I moved to Australia, of all places. I was hoping to work in Europe, but this was 2009. And this was height of the financial crisis. So the European Union was not keen on giving year-long work visas to, Americans, taking jobs out of the EU. So I didn't get approved for a work visa, but a friend of mine who I worked with at Le Cirque said, hey, I'm working at this incredible restaurant in Australia. At the time, they were number one restaurant in Australia. I think you'd really, dig it here. You should come. And I applied for a work visa and under an hour, I got approved. So
wow.
Australia was willing to say, come on down and, make this place home for a year. So moved there. Worked in Australia, my visa expired. And at that point, I had gone back to Atlanta because I wasn't sure what my next move was.
Mm-hmm.
And I had kind of toyed around with the idea of working in a hotel and started working at the Four Seasons. And I was working there for a while. And I kind of got burnt out of it. You know, it was working in high-end hotels is a really, really tough business. And I just, you know, said, you know, I'm not sure if this is something that I want to do long-term.
Yeah.
And I went back to business school, and I was in business school in Atlanta, and, you know, I needed to make money. So I literally just Googled being a private chef. So this would have been 2011. And I just Googled what being a private chef was. I found an agency, and I worked for the agency, and I was kind of working with that agency and ended up leaving the agency and finding my own clients. And I was finishing business school, and I was toying around with the idea of going into finance and working, you know, pursuing a career in corporate finance or management consulting or something along those lines. I just figured maybe I'll just get a, you know, 9-to-5, you know, finance job, and that's what I'll do. And a friend of mine said, hey, an A-list actor celebrity is hiring for a private chef. And I was asking about the job, and she was saying, you travel the world. I mean, there's not a country that you won't go to. And I think at the time they were in Namibia, and they were going from Namibia to Malaysia, and then from Malaysia to London. I'm like, I've never been to any of those places. Count me in. I'm corporate finance is out. This job is in. So
let me make sure I have this whole timeline straight, because this is pretty bonkers. So you go to Australia, you're thinking like, hey, I'm just going to go to Australia, work for a year, have a great experience. You come back to Atlanta, you think, okay, Four Seasons, let's give it a shot. But that, from what I understand, that kind of scared you away from the chef life for a while. You're like, this is really intense. Let's go look about finance. Let's go look about a 9-to-5. And then all of a sudden, the chef life is pulling you back in.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I was kind of burnt out. And then I was, you know, in business school. I was like, you know, God, you know, maybe just a 9-to-5. I cook on the side. I do something, you know, I just have fun with cooking. But it really wasn't me. Like, I was just fooling myself and thinking that that's something that I was going to be happy with. Because I knew deep down that, you know, doing management consulting was not going to bring fulfillment to my life. Or, working in corporate finance, it was not going to be fulfilling to me.
Yeah. I hear you. I remember when I was in college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And there was like a seminar on campus about becoming an actuary. And they were like, oh, actuaries make like, you know, 6 figures right off the bat. And I'm like, yeah, let's fucking go. Let's do this. And I went to one seminar and I was like, I still don't have any idea what an actuary does. So I'm going to go be a podcaster instead. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I completely resonate with that feeling of this is not me, though, with being confronted with a path that seems easier, but then you're just kind of like, nah, that's not me. Okay, so can you tell us who this A-list celebrity is that you worked for?
I won't say the name, but they'll say they're known for doing their own stunts, and I'll kind of leave it at that.
I respect that. I can respect that. Okay, so talk to us through that. Okay, you're traveling the world. You know, it sounds like you went all over the place. Can you give us just like the craziest story you have from your private chef days, being the private chef for this unnamed A-list celebrity who does their own stunts?
You know, it was an unbelievable job, because the client was fantastic, wonderful. But then, you know, you were thrown in all these different situations in which you had to, you know, to think really, really quickly on your feet. I was explaining, it was like every day was like an episode of Chopped, but instead of wacky ingredients, it was just wild scenarios. I mean, there were times in which I'd be in the French Alps at a, you know, cooking out of a chalet in the French Alps. And then I would have to have breakfast ready in the French Alps. And then I would have to jump on a helicopter and, you know, get to an airport and fly to London to have lunch ready in central London.
Wow. And like before your client got there, that kind of thing?
Yep. There are times, I mean, I cooked on, I think, an aircraft carrier for 2 weeks at sea. So incredible experience, though.
Were you getting like ingredients flown in or shipped in onto the aircraft carrier?
I had brought everything with me on board. So I had taken everything with me and, you know, couple massive Whole Foods trips. So
it's like Below Deck, but like without like the drama. Yeah. Although I'm sure you had your own drama.
There was some fun, but
no. Good to know. Well, so how did you end up leaving this life?
So it was a great position, a great experience, great client. Everything was wonderful, but I felt a little bit stuck. And again, it was kind of that fulfillment. Like I wanted to do something a little bit bigger, and I wanted to kind of, you know, work on an idea and see that idea come to fruition and, you know, really just be a part of something a little bit bigger. And not that, you know, what I was doing was, you know, I didn't like, I loved it. I loved every minute of it, but I just wanted to do something a bit different and kind of get out of that world. Also, it was a lot of travel. So a lot of traveling's great, but, you know, not when you're, you know, in one place, you know, never in one place more than 2 weeks or a couple weeks. So
for me, when I think about what gives people who cook joy, I also gravitate sometimes towards thinking of like, well, they love feeding people, right? Like they love bringing joy to people. And it sounds like you were doing that for one person. Well, I'm sure it wasn't just one person when you were a private chef. There were probably other folks that ate with that person and whatnot. But is that what you mean by doing something quote unquote bigger, like doing something that reaches more people?
Yeah. You know, I had always wanted to, you know, get back into the restaurant business. I've always loved restaurants. And what I loved most about it was hospitality, kind of what you're talking about, which is, you know, taking care of people. And I always tell people that, you know, you either have hospitality or you don't. You either want to take care of people, want to entertain, really want to care and nurture for people, or, you know, it's not what you're interested in. And when you're in the restaurant business, you get to encounter people. Maybe they're coming in for a special night. You know, this is their one night that they get to go out to eat. Maybe they're a regular and you get to take care of them that way. Maybe they're celebrating an anniversary. You know, maybe they're someone graduated from college. Maybe it's just a casual date night. So you get to, but you know, regardless, you get to take care of people. And I think that's what I really love.
How did you meet Mr. Jerry Greenberg?
So I got introduced to Jerry through a mutual friend of mine in Atlanta. And he was saying, you know, he was seeing, you know, how nutty I was with cooking and creating dishes and really diving deep into, you know, perfecting, you know, dishes. And he said, you know, I know a guy in LA, restaurant guy, who's as crazy about food as you are. And at this point, I was still in my private chef job. So I would come to LA pretty frequently for work. So a friend of mine made an introduction. Jerry and I had lunch together. And by lunch, he was said, meet me for lunch at Sugarfish. And we did Sugarfish, Wovo, Hi-Ho, and then finished at Kazunori.
In one day?
In less than 90 minutes.
Well, for listeners who don't know, this is particularly convenient for Jerry because he's an owner in all those restaurants, right?
Yeah. He's and they're all located within close proximity to each other, and especially in Santa Monica. You can walk to each one, which is what we did, or I rather rolled to each one of those after eating so much food.
But it was, so looking back on it, was he basically like giving you the pitch?
I don't know if he was giving me the pitch. I mean, we were just connecting about food, I think, at that point. You know, I saw what he was doing and, you know, thought it was just so, it was so fascinating. And, you know, again, you know, the way he thinks about food is the way I think about food. I mean, it's perfecting, you know, being product driven and trying to perfect the product. So I was just driven to that. And, you know, at that point, trying to remember what year this would have been, but this was maybe 2017, 2018. And so at that point, he had, you know, kind of thought about a steak restaurant, but there was a very, very loose idea of the concept.
Right. Cause I was going to say, like, I understand that at some point he went onto some sort of like very extensive steak journey. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So his steak journey is dates back a lot farther than mine. So, you know, 20 years ago, it's something like that. He was in the south of France and had this incredible steak eating experience at a restaurant in the south of France. And I think he had been on a mission to try to recreate that for a long time. And, you know, he found First Light, I believe, through a mutual friend of his, and found it. And it was like the proverbial light bulb for him. It was like, you know, this is the beef. You know, this mm-hmm. is the golden ticket. This is the magic product. And Hi-Ho was really formed out of that. So Hi-Ho came first. And, you know, they're forming their burgers. They're doing great. Then, you know, the kind of concept of the steak restaurant was still being formulated. And in that time, the steak club, which I know you had the kind of pleasure of getting introduced to the app and some of the meat, but the steak club was formed. And then, you know, about 2019, you know, end of 2019, 2012, we're really putting pen to paper, figuring out what Matu is going to be.
So talk to us first about First Light Farms. You mentioned it in passing. What is First Light?
So First Light Farms is a cooperative of farmers in New Zealand, and they raise 100% grass-fed Wagyu cattle. It is what we believe the most best-tasting, most healthful, and sustainable beef on the planet. And they're, you know, a company in the beef industry that is doing all the right things. And what I mean by that is it's exactly what they say they are. They're 100% grass-fed. It is a completely natural product, and it tastes unbelievable. They span between the North and South Islands, and it's just an incredible company.
So when you say, you know, they're doing everything right, what do you mean by that?
So, you know, in the beef industry, there's a lot of I'll just say kind of shady behavior. You know, for instance, you know, people will tell you that something is grass fed and it's maybe the cow just ate grass at some point in its life. It's not grass fed and grass finished. They're maybe not being transparent in their usage of feedlots. You know, they're kind of disguising their genetics. So, you know, First Light, when they're doing everything right, you know, I went down, I've been to New Zealand, I've seen the farm. And it's exactly what you would think. It's a, you know, a pasture or paddock of cows roaming openly in a field. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing that the first time, and just, you know, growing up, I'd seen all, it resonated really strongly with me because I'd seen the Lando Lakes package where you see the butter and then you see the cow in the field, but what it actually is feedlots, you know, somewhere outside Bakersfield in, you know, deplorable conditions. And I remember going out and, you know, visiting a First Light farmer, and it was exactly the pictures on their website. It was, you know, New Zealand is about as picturesque as you can imagine, but it was cows in a field eating grass. And I remember I was just blown away by it.
So Jerry finds his farm, First Light, and he's like, I have to do something with it. And the first thing that he does is Hi-Ho. That's a burger concept that opened, what, 2017, 2018, probably?
I believe maybe a touch earlier than that. Let me say, I think they opened in Ojai in 2016, 2015, something around there. And then they closed that down because everybody lived in LA. So they moved operations to Los Angeles and they opened Santa Monica. Now they have 4 locations.
But at that point, Jerry's like, okay, Hi-Ho's great, but there's so much more we can do with this incredible product. And that's when you start to enter the picture a little bit.
One of the, you know, a couple of the other founders, you know, Mark Schatzker, Lowell Sharon, you know, they had been working, you know, I think that was at the point that they were, you know, they were talking about the concept, testing some recipes. Mike O'Dell, who's one of the other founders as well, was working on the concept, as well as Ryan Ginola, who runs it, who I believe you met at the restaurant, who runs everything. Mm-hmm. At that point, you know, they kind of been working on the concept. Now it's actually one of the last ones to kind of enter the picture. And, you know, at that point, this must have been 2019, where, you know, really working in the test kitchen, developing dishes, testing the beef cooking process, which took, you know, an ungodly amount of time and an ungodly amount of steaks to figure mm-hmm. out how to create the perfect steak. So that's really where most of the time in developing all the recipes lied.
So Matu is now a concept. Maybe the name isn't decided on yet. I know that there are some other names in play, but
there are a lot of other names that, you know,
a lot of which I'm not sure.
I'm glad we did not go with.
Can we name the one you hate the most?
Oh my God. I don't think there's a one I hated the most, but there's ones I'm glad we didn't go with.
Yeah. Yeah. There's one I'm going to say, and you can always tell me to edit this out of the podcast, but you told me that Warm Red was in play, which really glad you guys didn't go with that. It sounds like a disease.
It does. It's the way that we describe our steaks and the way that we cook our steaks.
Yeah.
But yeah, glad we didn't name the restaurant that.
Let's talk about the cooking, because I, you know, as you mentioned, you know, there's the First Light Farms Steak Club, which is an incredible product, and we'll get into that in just a little bit. But one of the key things there is the cooking method, right? And I know we're not going to get into all the specifics of the cooking method, but from what I understand, there's a few different steps that are essential to the cooking process of a good steak. Can you walk us through what those steps are and how you guys went about figuring all those out?
There's, well, excluding butchering, which is a big part of what we do, and I, you know, I kind of consider that in the whole steak cooking process, and we can talk about that a little later. But the actual process of cooking a steak, you know, is from tempering, which is, you know, making it cold and making it less cold, or getting mm-hmm. it close to room temperature. There's a process of tempering, the process of seasoning, the actual cooking process, which also includes resting the steak, and then slicing. So every single one of those processes, we had to look really, really in depth and try to figure out how to perfect it and how to, you know, how to yield the best steak. But and not just the best steak once, but develop a process that was repeatable and easily repeatable, mm-hmm. which is really where the heart of R&D lies. You know, developing a dish, it's, you know, I can go and, you know, make a great steak, but developing a process by which people in our restaurants can actually execute day in and day out and be consistent is really, really where the challenge lies. So that was a bulk of the process. But something as, you know, simple as tempering, you know, we would sit there and temper steaks, and I would sit there with a laptop with Ryan, and we would just document notes and take steaks and, you know, put them in a little bowl of water or a little bucket of water and take the temperature of the steak, and we would build graphs and charts and try to figure out, you know, how to temper a steak properly. And then, you know, from there it was seasoning, and I would try to, you know, figure out how to season a steak properly. I would try to take a drum sieve and try to, you know, tap it with, you know, just the right amount of pressure to get the steak just right. And, you know, from there it was really kind of cooking the steak. Mm-hmm. And I think I mentioned this when we were having dinner, but at one point the true depth of insanity that we had gone down was we had this thing that we called the Franken grill. And what it was a wood fire grill, and I had drilled holes using a drill with a metal drill bit, and I was inserting thermocouples with high temperature adhesive into the grill grates, and then I had another thermocouple in between the grill grates to measure the air temperature, and then I had this big orb that hung over the grill to try to measure radiant heat temperature, and I would sit there with my computer, and I would just type away at what temperatures each, you know, thermocouple was at and what the steak temperature was at. And it was complete madness. And
the theory being that you have all these different types of heat and that you needed to basically be able to find a grill that could measure all of them, and that grill didn't exist.
Yeah. And, you know, we're trying to figure out, you know, not just that, but, you know, what is the perfect grill? What's the perfect grill grate? What are the dimensions of the perfect grill grate? I mean, I, you know, I remember at one point we were asking, you know, people who are experts in metal, like, is there a specific, you know, type of steel that, you know, has a, you know, nickel amount in it that, you know, makes for better heat conduction? And people had no idea what we were doing. They're like, are you with a research lab? And I'm like, no, we're just cooking steaks.
The level of detail and insanity, truly, it's like something reserved for like scientific breakthroughs.
Yeah, well, you know, I hope we made a breakthrough in the world of steak cooking. Maybe not, you know, anything of, you know, greater meaning other than that. But, you know, we spent so much time trying to figure out, okay, what's the greatest process? And what it really comes down to is like really simple cooking. Mm-hmm. Cooking steak over open fire has been done by humans for, I'll guess, thousands, if not longer than that, thousands of years. And that's exactly what we're doing. So there's nothing, you know, people would look at the process from an outside perspective and they'd probably see something that's okay. Well, you have some timers and you have an infrared gun that you take the temperature at. And they would think, okay, this process seems really simple. And the reality is the process is really simple. But yeah, the way that we got there was by trying to test every little thing that we could.
Yeah, I mean, so, what I love is that it sticks to, yeah, every single fundamental element of what's the temperature of the steak beforehand, which is true of any time you're cooking a protein. You want that protein to be at a certain temperature before it actually hits the grill, right? And then it's just figuring out, okay, now what's the temperature of the time it's actually cooking? What's the time it's actually resting? All that stuff, right? The craziness is that there's so many variables there. There's so many different variables that you can use, not just in terms of mechanisms, but also in terms of specific temperatures. How long did all of this take you guys?
Collectively, it took years.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? To really nail down the process, it took collectively years. And, you know, there are times that, you know, some of the parts of the process took a lot less time, like seasoning steaks. You know, that mm-hmm. was something that we just said, you know, this is going to be a trainable skill, and some, you know, we're going to be as consistent as possible, and we're going to spend a lot of time training people how to season steaks. The only way to do it is to have them season steaks and taste it. So mm-hmm. it's an expensive training process, but yeah, that's what you have to do. Something like, you know, trying to figure out the grill grates and, you know, the actual grill design took many, many months. Trying to figure out how to temper steaks properly, again, took many, many, many months. And, mm-hmm. you know, the whole process, even, you know, from the way that we butcher steaks, again, took a significant amount of time.
Yeah.
So we're talking years in the making.
Now, this is just the steaks, which are obviously the centerpiece of the operation at Matu, but you also spent a lot of time ideating sort of the eating experience, right? How you wanted to like actually course out meals and what you wanted to build around the steaks. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you did that? How did you not just deliver the perfect steaks, but also go about trying to deliver the perfect steak eating experience?
That was, you know, and shout out to all the wonderful people who graciously volunteered to eat all the dishes during the R&D process.
It's a hard job. Hard job.
it was a hard job indeed. you know, what we were doing, oddly enough, we didn't test, you know, I tested all the, you know, the dishes that we have a la carte, but what we were trying to do was try to create the set menu, the Matu dinner. That's what we spent a lot of time trying to focus on. And what we were trying to do was create a preset menu that was designed with balance of, you know, meat, you know, lean protein and vegetables, and that you could eat and feel fully satiated, didn't feel like shit afterwards, and that didn't break the bank. So that's what we spent a majority of our time trying to, you know, figure out what the Matu dinner looks like. And we tried every possible combination of different steaks and, you know, vegetables and dishes. And what we ultimately landed on was a, you know, a 5-course menu that had so many different techniques, a great balance of lean protein and vegetables. And, you know, you felt great after eating. And that was really important to us because what we, not only did we eat a lot of our own steak, but we went around, you know, eating steak everywhere else. And what we found was that, you know, a lot of the times you eat a steak dinner out and you feel like you ate too much and spent too much and drank too much. And we didn't want, you know, you drink too much, you know, that may be, that may be something else, but we wanted to give people the option to where they could eat the Matu dinner or any one of our composed menus and leave feeling fully satiated and full and feel good. A meal that they can feel good after eating.
It's interesting. What you're saying reminds me of, you know, my wife is always trying to like better me, you know, she's always trying to improve me. So she gives me Christmas and birthday presents that are geared towards that. And she got me this book about like Japanese philosophy. And one of the Japanese philosophies that, you know, I read one morning was about eating and how like in Japanese culture, especially in like places where the blue zones, you know, where they like live forever.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, the culture is that you're only supposed to eat till you're like 85% full or 80% full or something like that. And immediately it made sense why I don't like going to sushi because I never feel like I hate myself, which is how I prefer to leave meals most of the time. But I see a lot of the same ethos actually in Matu, where it's like, you know, you want people to leave happy, satiated, feeling good, but not like they've eaten to their like 100 and over your 100% max, because that's when things really get dicey digestively, for example. You kind of, it feels like you guys have a bit of that almost like Japanese ethos, which is just interesting to me too, because obviously Jerry's involved with Sugarfish. So I'm seeing a lot of parallels between these restaurants.
It's, you know, it's funny you put it that way. You know, I didn't think about it that way, but you know, it is true. You know, you can eat sushi and you can feel good after leaving, and you know, there's an element of, you know, you can go to Matu and you can eat poorly. I mean, you can go, or not poorly, but
Scott's,
you can eat
like,
a lot.
Scott's like, I've done it. I've done it. Trust me.
I've done it too many times. I mean, you can go and eat a cheesesteak and, you know, a couple orders of fries and, you know, some desserts and, you know, probably not leave not feeling the greatest. But we wanted to give people, you know, with all of our preset menus and really a la carte items, you know, dishes that they can eat and feel good about eating. Mm-hmm, and that, you know, what that means is, you know, it's not overly fatty, overly rich, or, you know, they may be indulgent. In the case of our, you know, chocolate cake, that, you know, there's butter in it and, you know, a good amount of butter, but it's not a massive wedge, you know, mile high chocolate cake of it. It's
oh my God,
it's an appropriate amount.
And it's good butter, right? Like you can tell like you're eating like good shit when you're eating it. I'll tell you what, it was my birthday recently and we were just in the desert celebrating it with a couple friends, and our friend dragged us to Outback Steakhouse to try their Chocolate Thunder from Down Under. I ate like four bites of that thing. I was like, I don't think I ever need to eat again. Like it was that that fake. It was like eating straight up plastic, but like if plastic melted in like clarified butter out of movie popcorn, you know what I mean?
Oh my God.
It's the complete opposite of what you're describing. It's like there's a place for butter and a place for like, you know, dessert and whatnot. But I think what's impressive about Matu is the ethos of it throughout really shines. But I do have to ask you about the sort of signature dishes, some of the signature dishes that you've just alluded to. Let's start with the fries. I mean, when those fries hit the table, they're a showstopper. You know, everything stops, time stops, space stops, and then you put them in your mouth and you're like, I'm never going to be the same again. Can you tell us about how you developed those fries?
That's very kind. So the fries, you know, we obviously, you mentioned one of the other, Hi-Ho, who serves a lot of fries. So it's, you know, they had been cooking fries. And one day, kind of the formation of it was, I remember having a beef tallow fry several years ago and loved it. And, you know, took some of the Hi-Ho fries and, you know, was messing around frying it in beef tallow. Because again, you know, we kind of talk about First Light And, you know, using the whole animal and, you know, really being cognizant of the way that we use our products. Well, you know, cows have a lot of fat on them. And, you know, we have to use some of that fat. Some of that, you know, fat comes from the way that we butcher steaks. You're left with a lot of fat when you're done trimming. And, you know, we grind that up. You got to render it. And we were frying French fries and it was kind of a, oh my God, experience. You know, the great, you know, a great hi-ho style fry, but with a twinge of beefiness. And, you know, people don't realize, you know, how much work actually goes into, you know, they're presented with a seemingly very simple plate of fries. I mean, it, you know, it's, our fries are, there's no intricate sauces drizzled on top. You know, there's, it's a plate of fries with a little bit of parsley. So
how much work does it take for one plate of fries?
In short, it's a lot. So, you know, you have to take the potatoes, you have to watch, you know, the, you know, measure, you know, they have to hold the potatoes and make sure that the starch content is right. They got to cut them. They got to, you know, soak them. They got to drain them. They got to blanch them. Got to freeze them. And then, you know, at that point, then you're ready to cook them in the fryer. And for us, we have to render the beef fat and fill the deep fryers with beef fat. So it's a lot of work. It's a really,
how many fries are you taste testing personally every day?
So they always say that if you're tasting something, it's 3 bites. Anything more than that, you're just eating. So I eat fries every single day.
Well, you got to make sure they're right, you know?
Yeah. I always, the running joke is we're tasting fries and I'm always like, oh, there's a good one in there. I just gotta
keep looking. All right. I think there would be a petition for me to be fired off the LA Food Podcast if I didn't ask you about this cheesesteak. The cheesesteak that has blown up all of our Instagram feeds. You know, I've reviewed it on my LA Countdown account and, you know, absolutely fell in love with it. How did this cheesesteak come about?
So we're all from the East Coast. So Ryan and I are, oddly enough, both from Pittsburgh. Mike lives in the East Coast, from the East Coast. Jerry's from the East Coast. So, you know, it came from, you know, playing around in the test kitchen and trying to find something really delicious. And the early versions of the cheesesteak are a little bit different from what is currently in operation. But it was one of those things where, you know, a couple of late nights in the test kitchen and maybe a couple too many drinks, it was, you know, you have one bite and it was, and oh my God, you know, people must experience what this is.
Talk us through what's in the Matsu cheesesteak for the people who are living under a rock?
So it's a combination of sirloin, New York strip, and ribeye. The Matsu Philly cheesesteak has onions on it and Cooper Sharp cheese and a classic Italian long hot pepper, which can be pretty hot, but it's,
and the bun, it's great. The bun is a key part of this equation too.
Yes. A seeded sesame baguette roll. It's if you've been to Philly, it's very similar to kind of a Sarcone style bun.
Would you say that's your favorite Philly cheesesteak?
There's so many good ones.
I don't want to get you canceled or anything, but
you have to be very careful when the Philly guys come out and you start talking about cheesesteaks. That is a passionate group. I mean, we get people to the restaurant wearing cheesesteak hats, cheesesteak shirts, Eagles jerseys. You got to be careful what you say. I may keep that one to my favorite cheesesteak to myself.
That and the A-list celebrity you worked for. You'll keep those to the grave. Now, have you gotten any feedback from Philly folks on the cheesesteak?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that I'm really proud about, which is, you know, we didn't create, you know, we did not create a cheesesteak that was chefy or our version of a cheesesteak. We wanted to do a really good cheesesteak. So the reception has been great. People who come here and they're like, maybe they're from Philadelphia or, you know, New Jersey, and they're like, you know, I can't get a great Philly cheesesteak. You guys just, this is so great. It's so fantastic. So we've had great reception.
Yeah, well, it's well deserved, and you know, I'm definitely, now I'm craving one. I'm gonna have to come back ASAP for one. I do have to ask though, because like last time I was at Matu, one thing that really struck me, and you alluded to this too, is that the prices are really like scarily affordable. It's like $87 for the Matu dinner, if I'm not mistaken, for one person. I mean, you can't walk out of Funky with two pastas and a side of broccolini for that these days, you know. So like, how do you guys manage to keep costs down?
Well, it's certainly not easy. And, you know, it kind of comes back to, you know, the way that we look at food. I mean, we look at our kitchen and the way that we do things. We have to be incredibly efficient. Our dishes have to have meaning. We have to look at every piece of the puzzle. The way that we utilize the beef, the way that we cut the beef, the way our butcher team works in the morning, the way that we cook our dishes in the restaurant. The kind of overarching theme is it's the way that we do quality control and the way that we look at every single ingredient that we have. So it is certainly not easy. But you know, again, that was the goal of the business, which was we didn't want to be $87 is you know, it is a good bit of money to spend. But you know, it relatively speaking, it is a great price for an incredible value. And it's five courses, yep. Yeah. You get the bone broth, you get a beef tartare, you get a filet with the 47 salad, the braised beef cheek, the celeriac puree, and then a ribeye with broccolini. In short, it's not easy, and it takes a lot of commitment. A lot of commitment in looking at quality control.
I feel like I could ask you about things all day, but I can't let you leave without asking you about First Light Farms and the Steak Club, because yeah, we've talked a lot about, you know, this method, this cooking method. We've talked a lot about what makes the steak so good over from First Light Farms in New Zealand. But the crazy thing is that folks can have these steaks at home too, and they're available for purchase whenever. Can you talk to us about the Steak Club?
Yeah, but we got to talk about how you cook your steak. I mean, you killed it.
We can talk about that. You're being way too kind. I honestly was like so terrified to cook one. So the nice people at Matu and First Life Farms sent me a few steaks so that I could test them before I actually was able to talk about this with any authority whatsoever before Scott came on the podcast. And I have to say, they make it incredibly easy. Even someone like me, I haven't cooked meat in years because my wife has been a vegetarian for the majority of the time that I've known her. They made me cook a pretty decent. I'm gonna go ahead and say it, Scott. I cooked a damn good steak. I sent you a picture, and you could tell just by looking at it.
It looked great. I mean, that's why when you sent me the picture, I was like, dude, you knocked it out of the park.
Hiring?
Yeah, you know, our grill guy called out. We may need you to hop in.
Well, I've got to say, it is a testament to the club that if a guy like me can cook it, and I'm more of like a, you know, pasta guy making pastas in my kitchens, not a steak guy whatsoever. If I can do it, honestly, anybody can do it.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's the way it's set up, right? Like, you know, if you have a process that's super intricate and 20 different steps and, you know, all these different procedures, nobody's going to do it. So the process needs to be something that's, and this is the way that we look at the process at the restaurant, though the process at the restaurant is far more involved because we need to be much more precise. But it's really simple. And the First Light Steak Club is a subscription-based company. You get First Light Farms beef sent to your door every month. You get to join an app. You get, I think you got a chance to see the video recipe that explains everything, you know, really, really easy for you. And you get to join the app, which is, you know, a community of people who are all cooking the First Light steaks together. People are doing some fun things, comparing recipes. So it's a really, really fun app. It's really fun to be able to get the meat every month and cook it at home.
Yeah. I mean, look, at the risk of sounding like I myself am trying to sell this thing, I promise you guys, I have absolutely no stake, pun intended, in selling this whatsoever. But as someone who's recently started going out to Whole Foods and buying quality steak because my wife demands quality steaks, it's expensive. It's expensive either way to like get steaks, and knowing that you're not necessarily guaranteed the most quality stuff when you don't know where your steaks are coming from. I feel like it's a good investment to think about doing something like a First Light Farm subscription, because if you're eating steak every month, that can get expensive, and there's a variety of options. So we'll be sure to link everything in the show notes. And as I said, I have absolutely no incentive to sell this myself. So I believe that it's worth it. Truly. I mean, you guys have a great product.
Thank you. I mean, I always tell people, First Light makes my job really easy. We're just, all we got to do is cut it and cook it and serve it to people. Most of the heavy lifting has been done by the farmers.
Yeah, although it sounds like you guys did plenty of heavy lifting yourself. Look, Scott, you've been incredibly generous with your time today, but I ask this question to all our guests when they're on. So I have to ask you, when you look back on your journey so far, all the way from the Chick-fil-A's and the Waffle Houses of Atlanta to where you are today, what would you say you're most proud of?
I'm just super proud of, I'm just one piece of the Matsu puzzle. I mean, Ryan, Mike, Jerry, you know, the kind of core operating team. I mean, what we've created together, I'm so proud of the people that work in our restaurant and really make it special. I mean, really, that's what it comes down to. I mean, we can come up with any goofy cooking device, you know, goofy procedure, you know, ways of cutting beef, but it's really the great people that work in our restaurant that make unbelievable experiences happen every day. So that's really what I'm most proud about.
Great answer. Well, Scott, thank you so much for making the time to join us today. I think our listeners have learned a lot. And yeah, I'm encouraging everybody to go and get a cheesesteak ASAP.
And a steak.
And a steak, of course, not just the cheesesteak.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the LA Food Podcast. Thanks to our guest, Scott Linder, for joining us, sharing his story, and sharing all of the wonder behind the Wagyu at Matsu. I really hope you get there soon, dear listener. I promise you, it's the best bang for your buck steak menu I can think of ever having had in my life, and definitely in Los Angeles. Look, if you like what you heard here today, please go to wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a rating, a review, subscribe. Seriously, all that stuff really helps us make our way up the charts on Spotify and Apple, so I would be eternally grateful. We'll be back next week with another epic episode, but in the meantime, if you're looking for me, you can find me on TikTok, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube at the LA Countdown. That's TheLaCountown. You can also find us on Instagram at LA Food Pod. That's LAFOODPOD.